You're listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent in Birmingham, Alabama, a church with a heart for the gospel. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.
Good morning. Last Sunday was Pentecost Sunday, and today is Trinity Sunday, so happy Trinity Sunday. I loved singing St. Patrick's Breastplate. I hadn't heard that in a while. I really enjoyed that. So, in the middle of the service, I was still kind of writing down. I have to add my notes for Sunday school. So, bear with me. I think I'll start this way. We're talking about C.S. Lewis's book, The Great Divorce. And better than anything I can say about Lewis is, I think, just to read Lewis for ourselves to begin with and hear what he has to say. And so that's on your handout. Turn over to this is kind of the backside to me. It's page 102 and 103. We're starting in Medias Res, right in the middle of the story. And I'm going to give you just 3 points by way of introduction, just what you need to know just for this little passage, this little episode. You kind of need to know 3 things for this episode. And I'll read it to you in my best dramatic voice. But first of all, who is it? This is a conversation between two people, a woman named Pam and her brother. What are they talking about? They're talking about the death of Pam's son, his name was Michael. He died in an early, untimely, tragic death. That's kind of the subject of their conversation. But the most important thing to know to understand Lewis's book here is where this conversation is taking place, because the conversation about Michael is not taking place on earth. It's taking place in heaven. So that's really important to understand what Lewis is all about here. And I'll read it for us here. Let me begin. All that 10 years of ritual grief, keeping his room exactly as he had left it, keeping anniversaries, refusing to leave that house, though Dick and Muriel were both wretched there. Dick was Pam's husband. Muriel was the sister of Michael. And then Pam responds, "Of course they didn't care. I know that. I soon learned to expect no real sympathy from them." "You're wrong. No man ever felt his son's death more than Dick. Not many girls loved their brothers better than Muriel. It wasn't against Michael they revolted, it was against you. Again, against having their whole life dominated by the tyranny of the past. And not really even Michael's past, but your past. You are heartless. Everyone is heartless. The past was all I had. It was all you chose to have. It was the wrong way to deal with a sorrow. It was Egyptian, like embalming a dead body. Oh, of course I'm wrong. Everything I say or do is wrong, according to you." "But of course," said the Spirit, shining with love and mirth so that my eyes were dazzled. That's what we all find out when we reach this country. We've all been wrong. That's the great joke. There's no need to go on pretending one was right. After that, we begin living." "How dare you laugh about it? Give me my boy, do you hear? I don't care about all your rules and regulations. I don't believe in a God who keeps mother and son apart. I believe in a God of love. No one had a right to come between me and my son, not even God. Tell him that to his face. I want my boy, and I mean to have him. He is mine, do you understand? Mine, 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 forever and ever. He will be, Pam. Everything will be yours. God himself will be yours, but not that way. Nothing can be yours by nature." "What? Not my own son, born out of my own body? And where is your body now? Didn't you know that nature draws to an end? The sun is coming over the mountains there. It will be up any moment now. Michael is mine. How yours? You didn't make him. Nature made it, made him grow in your body without your will, even against your will. You sometimes forget that you didn't intend to have a baby then at all. Michael was originally an accident. Who told you that? Said the ghost. And then recovering itself, it's a lie, it's not true, and it's no business of yours. I hate your religion. I hate and despise your God. I believe in a God of love. And yet, Pam, you have no love at this moment for your own mother or for me. What I want to draw your attention to here is this statement from Pam where she says, I believe in a God of love. I believe in a God of love. That statement is striking, and it seems very current to me. It seems exactly like something we would hear today. What do you think Pam means by that? What does she mean, I believe in a God of love? What's she saying there?
She's revolting against a God that would take her son.
She's against a God that would take her son?
She believes in a God of her own making.
A God of her own making, yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Selfish.
Selfishness. Yeah. Yeah. Who's the most important person here? Yeah, it's Pam. Yeah. What is it? I think Pam is saying, look, I love these things. I love Michael. God is a God of love. Therefore, God is going to give me what I love. Right. And that I think probably we all say to ourselves in one way or another, in some form or other, at some point. Well, that's what there's a lot to unpack here in The Great Divorce by Lewis. And I could probably stop right here and just talk about this one little episode. This is just one part of this larger conversation that's happening in heaven. I'm gonna try to just focus us here, though, as a kind of introduction to Lewis this morning. And I know most of you will, most of you probably have heard, or a lot of you have heard of C.S. Lewis. And I'm gonna give you a very brief introduction to him, and then to this book, The Great Divorce, that he wrote. By trade and by training, C.S. Lewis was a medievalist. He's a scholar of medieval literature. Born, lived in the 20th century, but probably most of us know him better as a Christian apologist and a kind of fantasy writer and storyteller. But in fact, there's no real division or distinction between Lewis the medievalist and Lewis the storyteller, and that's one of the fun things or interesting things about this work here, the Great Divorce. One author that I read describing Lewis's popular work, which is where we're talking about now, is he says that Lewis is really translating these old Christian ideas for a modern audience in these kinds of popular works of spirituality. I thought that was a really succinct way of putting it. Lewis, he studied at Oxford, Cambridge, studied and taught at Oxford and Cambridge universities, made the cover of Time magazine September 8th, 1947, which I thought, well, that says something about Lewis's his popularity. It also says something about the quality of journalism probably in the 1940s. He was a member of a literary circle called the Inklings. Anyone ever heard that name before? Yeah, there's a literary circle that it included people like J.R.R. Tolkien, Dorothy Sayers, Owen Barfield, and they would meet at this English pub in Oxford, I believe it was, called the Eagle and the Child. And they would sit down, they bring kind of their drafts and discuss their writings. There's even stories of that some of them just got sick of hearing about hobbits. If David Fleming is listening, I think Birmingham could really use an English pub, by the way. It's just, I don't want to get too far off there, but what about The Great Divorce? What is this book then? What is this book, The Great Divorce? Lewis, if you turn over your handout that I've given you there. Lewis calls this book a dream. And I think by dream, what he's telling us there is that he means this is a kind of a fantasy story, kind of a fantasy dream. This was something that the man that he called his own master, George MacDonald, had written in one of his great works called Fantasties. It was a kind of fantasy dream world. And like all of Lewis's work, it has a kind of spiritual meaning, of course. So, as a matter of literary genre, we could say that The Great Divorce is a theological fantasy. It's a fantasy based on an ancient Christian idea, which Lewis would have known from his scholarly work, called a refrigerium. And I had never heard of this term myself. And I don't think Lewis intends for us to, he doesn't necessarily intend to, this is just kind of the mechanism of his fantasy story, how it goes. But what a refrigerium is, if I'm saying that right, is it's the idea that the citizens of hell, the hell dwellers, the people in hell, occasionally are granted a visit to heaven. And so they get this kind of a holiday from hell. And the really interesting and odd thing, and we'll talk about this in the coming weeks as well, the odd thing about Lewis's story of this refrigerium is that the hell dwellers, the citizens of hell, when they get to heaven, they don't really like it that much. And that's kind of poignant. That's kind of key to how this story turns. Lewis's refrigerium, it takes the form of a bus ride. All right, so the citizens of hell all board up and they get on this bus. That makes it then a fantasy story, right, about a bus ride which originates in hell. So a fantasy bus ride from hell. That's what we're talking about. When you hear that, a mind-bending bus ride from hell, the first thing that came to my mind, and I was discussing this with some friends, was, well, that sounds like Ken Kesey and Tom Wolfe, right? But if you thought Lewis was the medievalist was gone into gonzo journalism, you'd be wrong. I'm thinking of the electric Kool-Aid acid test, right? But Lewis would insist that he is doing something actually more gritty and more realistic than gonzo journalism. And he'll claim that it's more realistic because he's writing about the most real place of all, heaven. That's going to be key, and we'll discuss the reality of heaven next week. But first, I want to talk about what Lewis means by divorce, that's key. And we'll begin by reading the introductory paragraph now that I've also given you on this handout here. There are several clues to the whole book in this first paragraph on the title page and the paragraph that I've given you here. And I just want to unpack today a few of these clues, especially the reference to William Blake and Blake's idea of marriage. And then second, if we have time, this idea of a perennial temptation that Lewis mentions. And then finally, we'll kind of wrap back around, if we have time, to Pam and her luggage, as Lewis calls it. So to understand this, we need to begin by asking who is Blake? Well, excuse me, let me just read the paragraph for us first and note a couple of things here. This is preface. Lewis writes, Blake wrote The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. If I have written their divorce, this is not because I think myself a fit antagonist for so great a genius, nor even because I feel at all sure that I know what he meant. But in some sense or other, the attempt to make that marriage is perennial. The attempt is based on the belief that reality never presents us with an absolutely unavoidable either or, that granted skill and patience, and above all time enough, some way of embracing both alternatives can be found, that mere development or adjustment or refinement will somehow turn evil into good without our being called on for a final and total rejection of anything we should like to retain. This belief I take to be a disastrous error. You cannot take all luggage with you on all journeys. On one journey, even your right hand or your right eye may be among the things that you have to leave behind. And we can already, you may already have a sense then of what it is that Pam, in her case, has to leave behind here. Let me just start there with that reference to Blake and talk a little bit about that. Lewis is talking about a 18th, 19th century romantic writer and poet, William Blake. You may have heard that name or reached back in your memory to college literature courses. Who is this Blake, and why does Lewis oppose him so much, and also why does Lewis insist on this really harsh language of divorce, which seems very unhappy and kind of uninclusive language for Lewis to use. Blake wrote this work titled "The Marriage of Heaven and Hell." That's what Lewis is referring to. And Blake's marriage, I'm not going to read that for us. It's just, I tried to read it. It's very esoteric and difficult to understand. And I found another poem by Blake that I think gets at something similar in a much more kind of easy way to understand. I think we can kind of catch his meaning, Blake's meaning here. But in summary, Blake wrote very strongly against traditional Christian morality and ethics, and with all of its limits and laws, and you could hear that, and I think you could hear that in Pam's voice as well. I don't like your religion with, I can't remember what she said, with its rules and stuff. Blake writes very strongly against Christian morality, and he writes powerfully in favor of the unlimited satisfaction of desire. That's what he is about. So let me read for us this poem from Blake. He writes, "I went to the Garden of Love and saw what I had never seen. A chapel was built in the midst where I used to play on the green. And the gates of this chapel were shut, and 'Thou shalt not' writ over the door. So I turned to the Garden of Love that so many sweet flowers bore. And I saw it filled with graves and tombstones where flowers should be, and priests in black gowns were walking their rounds and binding with briars my joys and desires." Wow, you can just kind of feel Blake's kind of, you know, just, I don't know, antipathy or kind of resistance to Christianity, you know, and the church. In the midst of the Garden of Love, and I wonder if Blake means for us to kind of think of the Garden of Eden, that he's telling maybe the real story of the Garden of Eden or something. Blake, he found something had intruded on this pristine green, and it was a chapel, and it didn't belong, of course. Again, I wonder if Blake means us to think that this is the intrusion of sin on a perfectly good humanity. He's retelling in his own way the story of the Garden of Eden and the fall of humanity. In the place of free play and love and desire, Blake, what did he find? He found written over the doors of the church, "Thou shalt not." And in the place of life and love or death and these black-clad priests who, they're like Christ's own executioners in a way. They place on his desire a crown of briars and thorns, don't they? Very strong imagery from Blake here. The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, his work, The Marriage of Heaven and Hell, I'm not really even sure how to characterize it. I guess it's kind of a poem. Lewis himself, he says, "I'm not even sure I feel that I know what it's meant." So that kind of gave me a little bit of comfort there. But this Marriage of Heaven and Hell, it basically says something like the same thing here, but just in even more occult terms. He even has a section of in The Marriage of Heaven and Hell where he gives the proverbs of hell, just like, you know, the Bible presents itself as if it's giving the proverbs of God. Blake says, "I'm going to tell you the real, you know, real wisdom, the wisdom of hell." So, he's you know, unashamed in his rejection of Christianity, I think. What he means, though, by this term, the marriage of heaven and hell, What he means is that the things that Christianity and the church have called sin and hell, they're not really that. That's not really true. They're not really so different, heaven and hell, in fact. This is a false distinction. The whole either-or of heaven and hell is false and wrong. That's just the imagination and kind of made-up morality of these moralistic priests. Heaven and hell, for Blake, must not be separated. He says they must be married. This is who Lewis has in mind when he titles this book, then, and it kind of characterizes this is kind of characterizes everything that Lewis is against. That's why Lewis writes it and titles it with this such a strong term, divorce. And on the same title page, look back at your handout again, he gives us right there at the front before you, on the title page, he refers to another romantic genius who I mentioned, George MacDonald. This is Lewis's guide, and he refers to MacDonald various places in his writings, all over the place, really, and he kind of calls him, I think at one point in this book, his master. He takes the in fact, MacDonald takes the place of Beatrice for Lewis, as Beatrice was what was a symbol of divine love that led Dante through paradise. MacDonald, he says, is his Beatrice here, who's going to lead Lewis in this dream vision through heaven. And this is the quote that Lewis gives us from MacDonald. No, there is no escape. There is no heaven with a little of hell in it. No plan to retain this or that of the devil in our hearts or in our pockets. Out Satan must go, every hair and feather. Heaven and hell are within our hearts, as Alexander Solzhenitsyn would say. They're both within our hearts. And to enter heaven, hell and Satan must be cast out, every hair and feather. This is the unavoidable either-or that Lewis refers to there in that preface paragraph. We must choose heaven or we must choose hell. They cannot be merged or married, as Blake thought. All right, let me stop right there for just a second. That gets us through, that's kind of a speedy run through the title page and the first paragraph, right? So we've got 34 pages more to go today. So I've, yeah, let me stop there for comments, questions on Blake and Lewis and what he's kind of means for us to see here.
So Lewis is going to take apart everything you just said.
Yeah, all these themes, he's
against
this kind of idea of Blake's, that we don't have to give up the things we really love. Even to take Pam's example, you know, the sons, the daughters, family members, you know, who we dearly love on earth. Yes. Yeah, he is.
He was the only one blowing that horn, though, Blake. Was he in iron and all that?
Yeah.
There and the whole enlightenment thing, which was disassembling what had been the spiritual reality. So
yes.
What comes into that void?
Yeah, there's I just know the vague outlines. This is the romantic movement, which is really a reaction to the harsh rationalism of the Enlightenment and urbanization and kind of industrialization. They want to get back to nature. And nature is seen as this place of you know, pristine beauty, stained by human sin. And where the romantics, like Blake, and you may know better than me which Shelley and I can't remember who else, Lewis refers to a couple of them indirectly in this book, where they really go wrong is I think there's something really valuable about recognizing the problems of again, kind of, you know, industrialization, industrialized society. But where the romantics really go wrong is in assuming that human nature is also kind of pure and pristine. And that's what MacDonald, to my take, you know, my kind of, you know, first reading of George MacDonald, what he offers as a romantic, kind of this fantasy, imaginative fantasy writer, is he MacDonald sees that, yes, human nature is still fallen. And he's not a rationalist, an Enlightenment rationalist. He writes these, yes, highly imaginative pieces, but the dark side of human nature for MacDonald is ever present. There's a kind of shadow that, and I think MacDonald, that's the same kind of thing that you see following Lewis, following also Tolkien, following, right? You know, Tolkien's the Lord of the Rings. What you know? There's always the shadow side of things. Yeah. So that's Lewis. I say all that because Lewis writes that in his kind of pre-Christian, you know, he's kind of hostile to Christianity early in his life, and he was reading all these romantics and just loves them, and eventually converts to Christianity. This is part of his. He doesn't fully give up all of his kind of romantic proclivities, but this is part of it. This is what he gives up. This naive view of human nature that we can just go back to a pre-Edenic state, you know. Okay, well, or shall we move on? Yeah, yeah. Comments? Yeah.
It strikes me that Blake and other anti-Christians who talk about, you know, taking away all the things they want to do and all the good things,
yeah,
and the strict moralists, I mean, they're just totally missing the point that we're all sinners. And
yes,
the only way we even have a chance at heaven is through the grace of Jesus Christ. So they miss the entire point.
Yeah, and I agree. That's exactly what they miss. And there's, I mean, even up to this day, their influence is still with us, I think, in a lot of ways. And that's why I think that line by Pam, you know, I believe in a God of love. Well, okay, great, but the story is more complex than that. Yeah. Okay, let's see, how much time do I have? I'm going to be a little bit controversial here, in fact, and give you an example where I see this kind of romanticism, Blake's kind of romanticism playing itself out. So this is a little bit of a trigger warning for you. All right. yeah. Blake's words clearly have kind of hit their mark, and I think a number of Christians have been stung by these kinds of words from Blake. And this quote comes from a recent report from, I'm not going to say any more than to say, two clerics in the Church of England, and they make this really bold claim: Christians should ensure that all loving relationships matter and are valued in everything that we do. I don't know if these men that wrote this had actually read Blake, but they certainly write as if they had. In any case, they prove, in my opinion, that this attempt to marry heaven and hell is perennial, as Lewis said. This is the perennial temptation. I think the key word here in this quote is that word all. The word all here, and this is a kind of a call out, a kind of bubble in this report. The word all, what it does is it kind of puts all relationships on equal footing, all loving relationships on an equal footing, as if they were all equally valuable. It has this kind of leveling effect. Anyone that claims love is their motive, you know, I love my son, a mother's love for her son is inviolable, so forth. Has anyone that can claim love has the blessing of the church, right? This is love is love. You've seen that, right? That's kind of the words of the prophets written on their on the subway walls and their yard signs right there. And this is a kind of, I would call it the deracinated sentimentalism that C.S. Lewis is opposing. Of course, love matters. Of course it does. Lewis is, that's obvious. There couldn't be anything more obvious than that. But what Lewis is saying is that all love does not matter equally. And some loves go bad. Some loves must be cut out of our hearts, and some loves must even be divorced. that's where Lewis comes in, and as a kind of critique against these kinds of statements. And I'm going to speed through that. Yeah, the report was titled "Love Matters," easy enough to find on the internet. Let's go back to Pam then for a second. Well, I'll tell you what. Actually, I'm gonna draw us to a close a little faster than that. Let me just draw a few conclusions then for us. The Great Divorce, as you saw in that preface paragraph, is Lewis's. It's a kind of meditation on Christ's words from Matthew 5:29-30. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out and throw it away. If your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off and throw it away. And this is a kind of extreme teaching, isn't it? Right. And probably every Sunday school class and preacher that has ever had to deal with this is I mean, that's the first thing you've got to address, is this seems to be such an extreme teaching, and it really is. And did Jesus, the gentle soul, God's apostle of love, he just couldn't really mean the plain sense of those words. And yet the Gospels are full of this kind of extreme teaching. Luke. I'll give you a few examples. Luke 14:26. Anyone who comes to me and does not hate his own father and his mother and wife and children and brothers and sisters, yes, and even his own life, cannot be my disciple. Again, Luke 9:62. No one who puts his hand to the plow and looks back is fit for the kingdom of God. And Luke 19:21. Sell all that you have, sell all that you possess and follow me. This is this kind of extreme divorce that Jesus is calling for between everything, every other love. And Lewis is using the exact same kind of extreme language that Jesus uses, and kind of trying to unearth and dig out what that, you know, excavate that for us. But at the core of this, at the core of the issue here is love. And false love is idolatry. Idolatry is about the thing that we love so much that nothing short of cutting it off will do. We have our idols, and I think it's also true, I'd like to explore this sometimes, I think it's true, we have our idols, but our idols have us as well. And they do their work by means of our desire, and that is why it's just so hard to give up our idols, and sometimes to even see them, because we love them and we have a grip on them, but they have a grip on us. And when it comes to justifying our idols, when it comes to justifying our false loves, we are all kind of like Blake. I mean, we are geniuses at justifying all of our false loves. We will just exert all of our power to prove that all relationships must be valued. But Christ and Lewis are standing against something like that. Unfortunately, we can't really change what we love. That's the difficult thing of it all. We have some power over our desires, but not, I would say, we're not really fully in control of our loves. We just love what we love, and what we love sometimes loves us back. And the only kind of transformation that can really change or have an effect here is the work of God's grace. And that's what we'll talk about next time, the work of grace, the effects of grace in the Great Divorce, and the state of, I don't know a better term to use than beatitude. I don't know a more comprehensive term to use this kind of heavenly state of grace that Lewis describes, really kind of imaginatively and a lot of fun metaphors and things. So let me wrap up there. I think we can go for a minute or two with a few comments or questions if anyone wants to add anything. We got our minds around all that? Yeah. Yeah, Eric. Yeah, can I summarize what I hear you saying? I mean, part of what you're saying is that, yeah, we can't reason our way to God. And that's always been a kind of human tendency. And at the same time, I mean, our natural reason has some you know, it has some power to get us so far. But beyond that, yeah, we must. There must be grace. There's no reasoning your way to the triune God, certainly not. And that's the work of grace that that does that work and brings us into the life of God. Yeah. Anything else? Comments? Well, thank you all for being here. We will talk about the nature. I guess another way to put it is kind of the nature of heaven, like what C.S. Lewis describes heaven. I start out with kind of like the flora and fauna, the ecology of heaven. That's one of the most fun parts of Lewis's story, is just how he describes the grass and the birds and the flowers and that kind of stuff. And we'll talk about what heaven is like. Heaven is true reality, as Lewis describes it. So, if that's it, then the grace of the Lord Jesus Christ and the love of God and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you all. Amen.
You've been listening to audio from the Cathedral Church of the Advent. If you live in Birmingham or find yourself visiting, we hope you'll join us for one of our Sunday services. Find out more at adventbirmingham.org.